start getting now into the issue, and we set the groundwork for it a little bit last time, but we've been setting the groundwork for it throughout, because all of these sugyas are interrelated, as we'll see. There is a thread that's going to run through everything, and that each new topic isn't really starting afresh, but is drawing on foundations from before. So, having discussed issues of psak in general and issues of the composition of the bezdin and what a bezdin can and can't do, then we started talking about a bezdin of one. Spoke about that a little bit. And now we want to get involved in a sugya, which is really a sugya a little bit later on in the Masechta, but we won't necessarily get there, so we might as well talk about it now because of its significance, but also because the Gemara brings it in here, the whole issue of making a mistake. And the reason it gets into our Gemara is through the path of the Yochid Mumcha, and the Gemara throwing in this fact that Kabbalah plays some kind of a role in something. And that's not a Madonna statement. That's saying that Kabbalah, in the sense of acceptance, that if you accept the Yochid Mumcha, so then that has some nafkamina lahalach. And we saw that it's not clear what kind of nafkaminas it has, but we know at least our Gemara tells us it has nafkaminas for the liability of the dying. And we took some suggestions last time, and we're going to see maybe that they played out in the Rishonim a little bit. Did you get that sense, by the way, when you saw the Rishonim today? Did you get a sense that some of what was suggested last week was finding expression in some of the Rishonim? Did you see that play out at all? Right, so basically, through your suggestions, we had basically three approaches. Either that it's a type of ones, that even though we just read in the parsha that there's the concept of nezikin, that one is liable for causing damage to someone else, but we have to figure out, is there a limit to that? Is there a point where you're not chayav? So it's not clear that there is a limit, because we say adam hamazik, even the shogeg is chayav, and even apparently ba'ones, even against his will, he's chayav. But some of the Rishonim maintain that that's not an absolute statement. It can't be an absolute statement. But at some point, you are just an unwilling tool in God's plan here, and you did nothing even negligent, let alone intentional. And if it's really Omez Gomer, we're going to say you're not liable. So that might be one model, that perhaps we're talking here about something like that. We just simply cannot be held responsible for what happens. The second model that you guys suggested was that maybe there is a focus on the acceptance. That because the parties, let's say we talked about a doctor as a model for this discussion, and we'll come back to that, because after we see everything in the sugya, we'll use it to apply it to halacha maisa, including actual doctors. So we're going up and down for doctors. We use the doctor as a thought exercise to get into this sugya, and we'll come back to it on the way out. But the suggestion was, well, you go to doctors willingly. So when you go to a doctor, you are essentially being mekabel his authority, and that is going to somehow insulate him from liability. Then we had to develop that a little bit further, because we know that it's not always true. You have an emergency technician who may come and rescue you without your choosing to go to him. And so we had to expand on that a little bit and say either you accept the person explicitly, or the circumstances are such that we have an umdana that anyone who could be asked would probably accept it. So if somebody's in a life or death situation and there's no other trained professionals around, so it's a safe guess to say that if you could pause time and say, you accept it, the person would accept it. So that was the second model. And the third model was the idea that once this person is doing something he needs to be doing, something that is not only good, but is possibly mandatory for the well-being of society, so perhaps we have to allow for a certain amount of amnesty from mistakes, and that might play a role here as well. So keeping those in mind, so our sugya tells us that a dayan, if he is, let's say, a dayan mumcha, let's assume for a moment, a dayan mumcha, is he liable for his mistakes or not? So setting aside the very important issue, which we'll have to get to, of different kinds of mistakes, right, which the Gemara is going to talk about also, both here and later on, right? We know there are different levels of mistakes, but setting aside that important point, so here in our Gemara, the issue seems to be kapala. If you were accepted, then you're patur. And if not, not. So what is the nature of the patur of a dayan who was accepted? So one preliminary question, just also drawing on what we've discussed before, but it's helpful to keep this in mind. So it's part of the question is, do you need Kabbalah for anything else as a dayan? Right, that was something we spent some time discussing last week. So does the dayan have the authority to function in all ways like a Beis Din, like a panel of three, as if he was three? Or is that limited? And if that's limited, in what ways is it limited? So one significant issue that came up, which may also have relevance here, is the question of kfir. Right? Can this dayan impose himself on other people? So if he can, one way or another, so then the Kabbalah is addressing something else. And who did we see, for example, among many others, probably, who says that even the dayan yachid can function through compulsion? Tosus, right? Tosus over here. So if you're saying that anyway he can adjudicate whether or not the parties are willing, so then Kabbalah is coming to address something else. While if he wouldn't have necessarily been able to adjudicate without the acceptance of the parties, so then the Kabbalah might also have to address that, and that might be part of the puzzle. So, for example, we noted that the Rambam a little bit sounds like that. The Rambam sounds like only when there is Rishus from the Reish Galusa can the dayan function against the will of the parties. So then it might be that the Kabbalah is really about him getting involved in the first place, if we're talking about a dayan who doesn't have Rishus. Although the Tumim, Rav Yonasan Aivshus, disagrees with that read on the Rambam, and the Tumim assumes that the Rambam in that halacha was talking about a dayan who hadn't reached the level of mumcha around. So maybe that's why he needs Rishus. But a dayan mumcha, we don't know necessarily that he would not allow him to compel. Again, that's just helpful to keep in mind, because it's going to affect what Kabbalah is doing for us. Okay, so let's now consider some of the views of the Rishon. So on the one hand, you have the Balamor. There's also a Ramban like this, although as we'll see, the Ramban in different places seems to highlight different points. And we'll also see that it could be that there are a couple of different arguments here working together. But what does the Baal HaMor emphasize? The idea of onus. So how would you formulate onus in this context? Why would you say that this dayan is essentially completely helpless in this damage that was inflicted? What factors would you say are highlighted in order to make that argument? Aryeh?
Because he's a mumcha, so he has the knowledge necessary, and the mistake came not of his own control. If he hadn't had that knowledge...
Okay, so the knowledge is one part of it, right? So this person, you're saying, basically, he knows as much as he could possibly be expected to know. So you can't come at him from ignorance. That would, your next sentence would be that if he hadn't had that knowledge, then what?
We would have said that he could have known more, and therefore he had control over this.
Okay, so if he wasn't the mumcha, maybe we would say either that it's his fault for not learning more. Or you could say maybe to tweak that a little bit, that he has to be even more careful. Right, that when you know that your knowledge is incomplete, then you have to also factor that in. You know, it's interesting, Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he discusses the obligation of learning in general. You know, the whole question of how much are we obligated to accomplish in Talmud Torah. So he notes that the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, back to that as a halakhic source, that Hashokeach Dover Echad Melimudo Chayev Misa. Moshe writes that the Mishnah is telling us that somebody who forgets even one detail of his learning is in big trouble, is considered to be punishable. That's Kal Vachomer. You have to assume that you have to learn in the first place. Because presumably, not even learning it to begin with is worse than forgetting it. So Rav Moshe, when he was asked this question, I think the tshuva he was giving a speech to a Daf Yomi Siyum, says, you see here that the chi of Talmud Torah is to learn Kol HaTorah Kula and to chazer it as much as you need to so that you're not going to forget any of it. And then, if you've done that already, you can move on to other things. Not so hard. Right? But as long as you know Kol HaTorah Kula and you've chazered it to the extent that you're not going to forget everything, then you can move forward. This is the Kal Vachomer from the Mishnah saying that if you forget anything, you're in trouble. So the truth is, and I think Rav Moshe may acknowledge in the tshuva, Rabbeinu Yonah over there has a comment which undermines the Kal Vachomer a little bit, because maybe it's not necessarily the case that if you didn't learn in the first place, that's worse than knowing and forgetting. Rabbeinu Yonah says it's actually an instruction to Dayanim, saying the Dayanim who are expected to know everything, so that they can function effectively. So then, if they think they know, because they learned it the first time, and now they weren't careful to hold on to it, so now they have forgotten, that's where you have this terrible effect on the world. So there is an expectation that a Dayan has to know what he's talking about, and has to also know what he doesn't know, or know enough to be aware of possible gaps. So you could say that, listen, if you are not the biggest mumcha, so then that's either your fault for not being the biggest mumcha, or it's your fault for not taking extra care to be aware that you're not perfect. So you're not just in this human sense, but you're particularly imperfect. So therefore, be more careful, consult with others, look things up more, whatever it's going to take. So that's one component of it. But then where does the Kabbalah come in? So if the Gemara is specifically tying the Kabbalah into the Ptur, so why do I need that? If you just said, look, you're such a Talmid Chacham that you've done everything you could possibly do in terms of knowing what you need to know, so you're an honest. So where does the Kabbalah come in? How do you fit that part into the story, into that theory? Are you?
If he wasn't honest, then perhaps the litigants don't have, the parties don't have to accept his mistake that was done through Ones.
Uh-huh.
And so the Kabbalah is that perhaps they do have to accept that situation.
Hi, see, that's interesting. You're actually coming at it from the opposite angle where I was expecting you to. So I think what you're saying is that, listen, he has the right to say, you know, it's a little bit similar to what you find, for example, the Gemara says that Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira, that if I send you off on an Aveira and you do it, so I am technically not liable for that, because I could always say, well, I didn't think you were going to listen to me, that you know it's an Aveira, so you should listen to God, don't listen to me, so I just said it, but you shouldn't have listened. So is that what you're saying here? That the Dayan can say, listen, you didn't accept my ruling in the first place. So if you decided to go act based on what silly old me said, and just listen, of all things, so that's your fault. So why should I be liable? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It's not what I expected, and it's not how I think the Rishonim understand it so much. I think what they're saying is that listen, if you're already imposing yourself on other people, that itself is a decision. Now you better be pretty confident in what you're doing. If you're going to say, I'm so clear on the din that I can go up to people who haven't accepted me as a dayan and tell them what they have to do. So then you are basically taking a decision into your own hands, and therefore taking a fragus into your hands. But if they're makabli, so then you can basically say, okay, listen, now what am I supposed to do? So there is a mitzvah to bring justice in the world, that we've seen, b'tzedek tishpach. The people are saying, we want you. They're saying, we're going to follow what you say to us. So at that point already, so there isn't any greater step I can take to make sure this is appropriate. So if that's the case, we could say, all right, that's onus. That's onus gamma. So then maybe we specifically need the combination of all these elements. Now we need that he's somebody who is qualified, and we need that the people have willingly gone to him rather than him imposing his will on them. Okay, so that again lines up pretty well, I think, with the first of the three suggestions that we heard last week, that that's the issue. That yes, Adam Hamazik is always tired, but it's not as always as it sounds. There are cases where you are really not responsible here. And we gave the model also, let's say a doctor. If a doctor is fully qualified and fully trained and doesn't skip on anything and pays full attention and does everything that medicine has told him is an option, and the patient, Rahman al-Islam, still dies. So then at that point, we say that was God's will. I mean, it's always God's will, but then this was simply something there wasn't any possibility of him changing. So too, you find this in some of the Rishonim, if you saw this. Some of the Rishonim say in such a case that at that point, already with the dying, so the reason this guy had bad luck happen to him, or that's bad luck is the reason, but the reason this guy lost is because it was his mazel. It was because it was his bad luck.
Can we say that any time that you come before a judge now, whether it be, you know, he does it because he says, you know, without their official Kabbalah, but if they're going to sit and explain to him the story, that should be enough of a Kabbalah itself.
Oh, so you're asking a very good question. This is a question that very much the poskim want to try to figure out based on these possibilities. Your question is, what constitutes a Kabbalah? How explicit do we have to get? So, excellent question. We'll see that that's probably affected by this whole story. So, hold off on that. We'll come back to that for a minute. Very important question. Very much a part of the discussion. Okay. We find some of the Rishonim saying that if this is what happens, there's a mumcha who you're makabo, and still you get a bad decision, it's your mazel. Which enters into, in general, another question that we sometimes have with the contemporary Besdin system. Sometimes people, you know, you hear this from Baal Batim all the time, that okay, if the Torah tells them to go to Besdin, so what if they're not so confident that the Dayanim are going to not make a mistake? So, you know, that's a part of the discussion. We try very hard to have Dayanim who won't make mistakes, but part of the philosophical approach is that it could be that even in Timsi Lomar, the Dayan is going to make a mistake, so then that might still be the right mahalos. It might still be that that's what the Torah is saying, that when you have a dispute, we're asking you to go to Dayanim who are going to apply the Torah against the first mitzvah in this past week's parsha, Eilu HaMishpatim Asher Tosam Lifneihem, and ideally we will have honest and qualified Dayanim who will do the best that they can to give appropriate judgments. And if with all that, it happens to be that it's not actually what would have been appropriate for this case, so then that's the Ratzon Hashem for whatever reason. So that's one possible approach to say that essentially this is a type of onus. Again, that correlates very well with what you suggested on your own, and that's an idea that you find in the Rishon. Second idea that you guys suggested, so you also find in the Rishon, right? That maybe the issue is it's really all about the Kabbalah. That what happens with the Kabbalah is that the people are basically saying, we are willing to take the consequences of our decision. That if the Dayan, even if he's qualified, but he's imposing himself on people, so then they're like, all right, so you can tell us what to do, assuming you're right. They're not even saying that purposely. They're saying, whatever, we have no choice but to do what you tell us to do. But if they come willingly and say, we're willing to accept you, so then maybe that means we understand, okay, listen, you're a human being, you're not perfect, you're as good as we can get, and therefore we're willing to let you off the hook for whatever mistakes you might make. So that, some of the Rishonim, if you noticed, for example, you find this approach in the Rush, in the Yad Ramah, and a few other places, in whole or in part. So what they seem to be saying is that the Balabatim, they would have had to listen to you anyway, because the Yachid Mumche can be done with Kfir. He could decide to impose himself on them. So what's the value of Kabbalah? So that's essentially how the Gemara reads. That's essentially the words of the Gemara, that the Dayan Mumche can be done. And you want to know, are you off the hook for paying for mistakes? That's totally un-Kabbalah. So it means that the Kabbalah is there in order to say, we willingly accept the consequences of your judgment. We want your judgment to be guiding us, and we understand that even if it can be somehow defined as a mistake, we're okay with that too. So now let's consider a third approach. So this again is in line with what was suggested by you guys last week. So I mentioned to some of the guys this morning who were finding some of the Rishonim very long, that one of the sources I would have added was the Rambam. So did anyone look at the Rambam in the beginning of the sixth parak, Hilchos Sanhedrin? As we took a look at it. Right, so the Rambam gets into a lot of distinctions that we're not ready to talk about yet. But we'll focus on one line of the Rambam. The Rambam in Perek Vav, Halacha Aleph, without, again, skipping over the details. So the specific case which he describes here, where it's an irreversible mistake, the mistake can't be fixed. So the last line of this Halacha Aleph, he writes, so in this particular situation, Harezeh Potter Milishalim, this is a case where the Dayan is exempt. Why is he exempt? Afal pi shegarem lahazik, lo niskavein lahazik. Now the truth is that language, if you want to get very technical in Hilchos Nezikin, so that language requires a lot of explanation. Right, there are a couple of things that are unusual about that language. Anyone want to try to take a stab at it? What's a little bit, suppose at least two things about that last sentence that don't work well with Hilchos Nezikin from different directions. Eldar?
I was thinking just from a lot of people. I was thinking, like, what does he mean by Kavana? It's like Kavana to, like,
okay, what does he mean by Kavana? But not just that. I mean, you want to build on that?
Kind of scenario. Meaning, even if you didn't have Kavana, if you had damaged some of your stuff, you should still have to pay.
Right. Since when does Kavana define the issue? Right. Normally, Adam HaMazik, we've seen, okay, it's machlokas rishonim by onus gomer, but it doesn't go to kavana.
That results for people, not the kavana.
Yeah, just parenthetically, by the way, so again, this is very much a parsha topic. So this past week, so we read the parsha of Nezikin, about the chiyuvei Nezikin, and there's a big discussion in rishonim. If you were learning Bavakama this year, we spent a lot of time in this rishonim, and achronim. This is the big sheer klali that you always start Bava Kamma with. The first half of Bava Kamma, you have to figure this out. Bava Kamma is all about nezikin, is all about damages. And the Torah, in this past week's parasha, lays out the arba avos nezikin. And what the Rishonim and the Achronim struggle with is that it doesn't seem to say anywhere in this parasha that it's usher to be mazik. So let's say, for example, I'm going to come with my checkbook ready. I'm going to come and say, I'm going to smash your windshield in, and I have my checkbook ready to pay for it. So is that mutter? What do you think? Is that mutter? So how do you know it's not mutter? How do you know if I'm ready to pay, I'm going to fulfill my chiyuv nezikin that I'm not allowed to do that? So I think you all assume, which doesn't sound mutter, feels like it should be wrong. But why is it wrong? So there is a lot of discussion, many, many different theories why it is. So sometimes I point out, I'm talking about this topic, so we could go through 5, 6 different shitas, maybe more than that, as to what is the Isser Nezikin. So if we have to work so hard, why did the Torah leave it that way? Why did the Torah spell out the Chiyuve Nezikin and not identify the Isser Nezikin and left it to the Rishonim and Achronim to argue and to schwitz over this to figure out what the Isser is? So I think the point is that in a Hanami, if you're going to come and take a sledgehammer and say, I'm going to smash your human shield, so you will violate any number of Isser, any one of the different theories that the Rishonim and Achronim suggest. But the Torah doesn't necessarily go into that in Parshas Mishpatim, because that's not the point. Even though it's interesting that if you look at Usher Weiss's an essay about this, where he suggests differently, but I think Maseilas Kavodah, he can say differently that the Torah is sending you the message that the Chiyuvei Nezikin are not tied in to the Isser. They could theoretically be fully separate from each other. It could be that you didn't necessarily do any Aveira, and yet, you're chayiv anyway. So that's the point we saw before, that according to some of the Rishonim, even Onus Gomer is going to be chayiv to Nezik. So it's not necessarily that you did anything wrong. So, as Eldar and Tamir are asking, so why is the Torah here all, why is the Rambam rather, why does the Rambam say, oh, it's Pater, Ho'ol below Niskavim Lahazim? So that's something that have to figure out, but the truth is, the first part of the sentence was also a little bit surprising, right? Because what was his language before that? Afal pi shagarim lahazik lo niskavim lahazik. Why is that also surprising?
Why is that considered a problem?
So that's one question. Okay, that's also something that has to be figured out. And again, I skipped a lot of words in the Rambam because there's many different ways in which the scenario could play out. And so Arya called our attention to before that maybe sometimes a psak doesn't necessarily come with the expectation that they're going to have to listen to you. Sometimes, as we'll see, it's more active than that. Sometimes the Rambam and the Gemara is going to talk about nasam biyad, that the dayan may actually take the object away from one guy and physically give it to the other guy. And that's going to affect his chiyuv. So that's a part of the dynamics here. But there's something interesting about using the language garam lahazik. And that is that normally we say grama b'nezikin is actually potter. Right? That if you cause someone damage, you don't actually do it yourself, you don't take a sledgehammer and break something, but you cause it to happen. So then normally that's potter anyway. So then, that also has all kinds of variables you have to figure out. Are all grammas in Ezekiel Pater? Is the Rambam using the word grama precisely here? Does it have a halachic definition in other contexts? And here he's using it differently. It's interesting. Because normally, grama in Ezekiel, one is exempt. So he could have just stopped it there. Afal pish hayahezek, it was al yidei grama. But that's not apparently the nature of the Ptur. The Ptur is that he wasn't Mechaber. So what is he talking about? So some understood within this Rambam, this is the way the Brisker Rav understood it, if I'm not mistaken, and some of the Rishonim also allude to this on their own, that this is an example of what we talked about last week, of the concept of Mazik Birshus. So what does mazik b'rishus mean? So it could mean a few things. It sounds like the phrase just by itself, if you haven't seen that anywhere else, what would you think it means? Mazik Roshos. Right.
Someone says, punch me.
Oh, okay. So it sounds like we're talking about the reshus of the victim, right? Which maybe, since we're also talking about Kabbalah, maybe that does play in. That maybe, essentially, if the person says, listen, I don't care what you do, I'm not going to hold you liable. So maybe that's what it means, which is interesting because our Gemara talks about Kabbalah from the parties. Our Gemara also talks about Rishus and the Reish Galusa. So if we're going to say that basically the issue is that, look, there was a straight-out hezek here, but it happened with someone's permission, that makes a difference. So that's interesting to consider, because then maybe we mean the parties gave Rishus by their acceptance. They said, listen, we are willing to accept the consequences of the mistake you might make. Or maybe if we're talking about Rishus from the Reish Galusa and the like, so maybe he has that right. Why would he have that right? Why would the Reish Galusa say it's okay and that would have meaning?
Marty?
So maybe there's some kind of Hefker Bazet Hefker going on here. Right? That maybe there's a certain degree to which, on a communal level, we're saying that we're willing to accept the consequences of the mistakes and to sign off on it afterwards, or preemptively sign on it afterwards. And it's not about the individuals being the Kabbalist, but that's still a type of Rishus. So Rishus could allude to all those things. In the Gemara, Mazik for Rishus is used in a different context. So for example, the Gemara Bava Kamma, again, I could give you the sources to look at, maybe I'll give you some for tomorrow. Mazik Rishus in the Gemara and Daf Lamed Beis in Bava Kamma in the Mishnah. So one example you find is, let's say somebody is running around in the marketplace, and while he's running, he's mazik somebody's property. So then he should be chayiv. But the Gemara says, Erev Shabbos, when everyone's running around for Shabbos, he's patur. Mazik Rishus. So what does that mean? Whose Rishus was it there? The victim said, it's okay, it's Erev Shabbos, break my stuff. So the impression that you have there is that this is some type of mitzvah p'tur. That when you're involved in a mitzvah, so then we give you some latitude. And you find this phrasing also invoked in the Rishonim and in the later Sfarim, talking about almost in Yonah Yoma, or the next one on the horizon, Hilchos Purim. So you find some of the Rishonim say that there's a p'tur that applies on Purim. You also find this in some of the Rishonim in the Sefer Sukkah, talking about Simchas Yontif in general, that the context of Simchas Yontif in the context of Purim, so certain minor mezikin, you're exempt, and you find this phrase mazik rishus also. So it sounds like there's a concept of a mitzvah p'tur, and that maybe is playing a role here. We'll say, okay, the dayan is doing a mitzvah, a doctor is also doing a mitzvah. So maybe we give him a get-out-of-jail-free card. We give him this protection against being liable. Israel?
Could you make a difference between Shugel Hadass and Noah Shavu Mishnah in this instance?
Absolutely. You can make a difference even better if we had gotten into the concept yet. But in anticipation of that, do you want to spell out what you mean?
I mean, because maybe for Shugel Hadass would more be of an... I wouldn't say it's an onus, but it would be less of a pshia than of Devar Shavu Mishnah.
So I think you're right. Why are you bringing that up now specifically for that view as opposed to, let's say, for the first view? You're saying general.
Yeah.
You're not tying this to what we just said in the past 2 minutes. Right. It seems like clearly we know from our Gemara that there is such a distinction to be drawn. So we'll talk about that probably tomorrow. We'll get into more about the distinction. But it seems, let's say, for example, our first school of thought, that there is a distinction in the level of onus. That probably is the first place to explain why there should be a difference. Now, I think for any of these three theories, we'll be able to explain the distinction. But I don't know if what we're hoping right now, but Mazur Bashur said, let's say the first one, about onus, that works the best, right? That, okay, Tov Davar Mishnah, that's really your mistake. You should have known what's written inside. Well, Shiko Adas, okay, it's a little bit more, what could you do? And maybe even for the second idea of Kabbalah, but also when we have to define what Shiko Adas means, but maybe it works even better with a Kabbalah idea. This idea, I think to a certain degree, we see the distinction exists, and so we can work it into the model, but I don't know if it naturally flows as much. So the idea that there is some kind of a mitzvah exemption from the Zikin, so you find it in the Gemara in Bava Kamma, you find it in Hilchos Purim, you find it in some of the later literature. Just to give you an example, there's many tshuvas about what's essentially a minig. There's a minig to fast if Rachmana Litzlan, a Sefer Torah, should fall to the ground. So there's a lot of discussion about why that is. Is it because it's a bad sign? Or is it because you should have been more careful with the Torah? It's basically your kapara for not being so careful. So in that context, some of the Acharonim discuss with David Karliner and his Chumashay with David and a few others discuss that what if you drop a Sefer Torah when you were in the middle of doing a mitzvah, which is going to be 90% of the time. You're in the middle of Hagba, you're in the middle of Hakafos, in the middle of these count as mitzvahs, or let's say a more extreme version, the shul was on fire, Chas v'Shalom, and somebody ran into the shul to save the Sefer Torah, you think, or more so, he should not be considered liable if he drops it. So that's an interesting example to come back to. But one could say that you see in this literature that there does seem to be some mitzvah exemption. Now, it's important to try to qualify that because that could lead to a pretty dangerous society. Right? It means that the more religious your neighborhood, the more careful you have to be. As one contemporary author wrote, how far could you go with this? Everyone's going to have to walk around in armor and helmets because maybe somebody's on the way to a shir, somebody's on the way to a bris, somebody's just going to be speeding down the highway without looking and doing whatever he wants because he's involved in a mitzvah, and you're going to just have to jump out of the way of anybody who might be going to a bris or a shir or something like that. It's a pretty dangerous society. You're better off not living around any religious people, if that's really true. So, again, the letters back and forth about this, some very interesting letters that I can show you if you want to read. So, some point out that it's hard to say that that's really what Mazik Bereshus means. Mazik Bereshus doesn't necessarily mean that anybody who's involved in any mitzvah, whatever he does, is exempt. That would indeed lead us to a very dangerous society. What it means, and this is explained by the Chavos Yair in his Tshuvas a few hundred years ago. More recently, there's a Tshuva about this in the Tshuvas Netzach Yisrael that was written by Rabbi Grossman. Rabbi Grossman, the disco rabbi? Yisrael David Grossman? Sorry? Yes, Migdal David. Right, so he's known as disco rabbi because he's going to the discos on Friday nights and pull people out. So his father wrote the Shailos and Tshuvas Netzach Yisrael, so he talks about this there. They explain that this isn't some absolute get-out-of-jail-free card because you're involved in a mitzvah. What it means is that sometimes the mitzvah context makes it clear that there is a higher level of risk that people accept. So, for example, when the Mishnah says Erev Shabbos, or the Gemara there also talks about Hanukkah candles, when it's Erev Shabbos, we don't mean that, oh, because you're rushing to prepare for Shabbos, you're off the hook, you can drive at 80 miles an hour down residential roads with your eyes closed because you're preparing for Shabbos. It doesn't matter. Chas v'shalom. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that everyone knows it's Erev Shabbos. So therefore, that raises the bar as far as how much people have to protect themselves and their property. So as much as we say, Adamu the Olam, a person is always liable for his damaging, but we also know that there is a certain degree of expectation a person should be careful with his property. So if somebody decides to leave his iPhone on the highway and I drive over it, so presumably the guy who left the iPhone there is responsible for his own loss. It's not my fault if I'm driving on the highway and he happened to leave his iPhone there. So too, when it's our Shabbos, so people understand the pace of life is quicker and people are running around. And then they have a greater obligation to be aware of that. So it's not going to apply if somebody just happens to be running to a dris or a shir. It means that when there is a context which everybody understands, that things are a little bit different, that's going to change the dynamics. And then especially when you get into the Rishonim, we'll talk about Simchas Yontif or about Purim. So it certainly doesn't mean that, oh, because I'm having fun, like you see in Halloween, because I'm enjoying my Simchas Yontif, I can go vandalize people's houses. And Chas v'Shalom, that's not what we're talking about. It means that, let's say, I want to have you for a Purim Seder. So we're going to celebrate Purim together. So I know that if you spill a drop of wine on my carpet, I'm going to sue you in Beis Din. So then, we're not going to have much of a party. We know that we can't really have too much of a context here if everyone's going to be as machped as they could be on every little hazard. So therefore, in a context like that, so because the Kiyum Mitzvah is mutual and well known, so then we have an understanding that the Mitzvah allows for a slightly different attitude. And I should emphasize the Halach L'maisa, the poskim right there, that we're only talking about minor hezek, not major. If the guy not only spills wine in my carpet, but sets fire to the house, it's a different story. And also, even the small Nezikah in the poskim right, that really it's appropriate to pay for them. But, strictly speaking, there's a mechila on the behalf of the other party because they understand that's the nature of us having the celebration together. So, just to sharpen this idea of mazik v'rishus, so we don't necessarily mean, on the one hand, we're not going so far as to say it has to be the rishus of the parties, or in the middle, the rishus of the Reish Galusa, the reigning authority. We could mean that we're just talking about the rishus of the Torah, and the rishus that is granted by a Kiyum Mitzvah. But we have to sharpen what that means. It's not going to mean that any Kiyum Mitzvah is going to get you off the hook. It's going to draw on certain other principles, such as everyone understands that this mitzvah is going on, and everyone's interested in this mitzvah happening. Right, so if we make those part of the condition, so then we could say, all right, we need to have justice in the world. We need to have doctors. We need to have these mitzvot taking place. So we understand that as a society, we have to have some kind of leeway for that. So we could understand Mazik Rishos that way. That in all of these contexts, doesn't have to mean actual rishus from the parties, in the sense of the Kabbalah. It could mean rishus of the mitzvah, but even the mitzvah, not absolute, but mitzvah within a certain understanding, a mitzvah that we all understand this is a mitzvah, and we're all interested in doing this mitzvah together, so therefore there's a certain amount of leeway as far as how makbid we can actually be on a mistake. So then you put that into the Rambam's language. So we'll say, if you want to just also take a minute to think about how far you can go with this, right? So on the other hand, we talked a few weeks ago about Tov Shavuro from Lehanim. So we also don't want to necessarily go too far with this idea. We don't want to encourage a God complex, right? We don't want the message to be, okay, since we need doctors and doctors are doing mitzvot, so do whatever you want with it, and take this as a good opportunity to take revenge on your enemies, and agree to be their doctors, or agree to be their dayanim. So we need to have some limit on how far we're going to go with this. It can't be absolute. So if you take all those factors into mind, so then the Rambam could read pretty well. But the Rambam is basically saying that afal pi shagarim lahazik. So even though, yes, what he did with these litigants caused a loss, lo niskave lahazik. So what's he saying? He's saying that we should let him off the hook because he's not trying to hurt people. He's trying to help them. It's not just lo niskave lahazik, but it's that he's part of an effort that is mandated and necessary. You know, a drunk driver doesn't necessarily intend to mazik either, but certainly we're not going to apply that logic to him. So it's not simply lo niskave. Presumably what the Rambam is saying is that he intended to help the people. And it was socially expected that he would be helping the people. That was his job. So with all that together, we should give him some leeway. Also because he wasn't trying to use that job as a weapon. And it's lo niskave lahazik exists on two tracks. Right, first, a more positive track, that not only was he not niskave lahazik, but his job was to help. And within that job, he didn't misuse that job and actually try to cause a hazard. So with all that together, perhaps that's what the Rambam is saying. And you could also then connect that to the Grama Benazikin part. So normally, if it was just a Grama, you should be pater. But once we're trying to find the right balance between avoiding malpractice and also not discouraging practice, not discouraging the profession in the first place, so then we could say, all right, so we're going to hold you responsible if you intentionally cause a hezek, even though it's a grama. But if it wasn't intentional, then we're going to credit the fact that you are trying to help here and that you're licensed to help. That's crucial, as we'll see. So with all that, maybe that's the nature of the p'tur. Okay, so what have we seen? We've seen basically three models which all fit very nicely with the models you guys came up with on your own. Either that is basically, the guy is basically blameless. He's essentially an onus, and it's the mazel of the litigant that caused this problem. That's one. Or it's all about their acceptance. And third, that it's some form of the mazik perishos idea. So let's just quickly mention, we'll have to continue this tomorrow, and then we'll get into the practicalities also. We'll talk about how this applies to doctors, Bizman Hazeh, and other related things, and we'll have to get into what is Shikol Hadas and Tavadah HaMishnah and the like. But let's just mention, so what nafkaminas exist between the reasons? So can anyone suggest any nafkamina if it's one reason or the other, or how the halacha might be different? Let's say focusing on our sugya, let's focus on the Kabbalah part that the Gemara is talking about. So does anyone see any differences between picking one reason or the other? So one difference that the Shach mentions, and the Sos talks about also, is that does this logic also work for three hejotos? That if it's the Kabbalah that gets you off the hook, so then we should say that three hejotos also, you could be makabel them. And then maybe they should also be off the hook for any mistake. But if the thrust is that they're anusim, because they're anusim because they know everything they need to know, and you can't expect them to try to compensate for any ignorance, so then you could say, all right, but Hejot doesn't have that excuse. They're not fully educated, even though they have the Kabbalah. And therefore, they would have a responsibility to be more aware of their potential mistakes. So Sos mentions that, and he brings up a point that Eldar asked before, and others talk about this also, it's a very major part of the sugya. When we talk about Kabbalah, how explicit does the Kabbalah have to be? is the Kabbalah simply the fact that they come in the first place? Right? Is the Kabbalah basically anything other than Kfiyah? Is that just the way it is? Binary, either it's Kfiyah or it's Kabbalah? Or does this Kabbalah require something more than that? That they not only show up, but they explicitly say, listen, we're willing to come to you, and you should also know that if you make any mistake, we're also willing to accept that. That's how much faith we have in. So that's not a partial issue. That's an issue that the Ksos talks about as an afkamina for these reasons. And it's something that other Sfarim discuss at length also. We'll probably have to pick up with that point also. But before ending, we'll just briefly spoke about. So it's interesting. What do you think Rashi's position is on that issue? So let's look for a second together. Rashi and Hayyamin Aleph. How would you read this Rashi? When Rashi is Rashi saying that they have to be specific in being Makabel a mistake too? Or is the default that if they come, they're Makabel? So let's look at this Rashi together. Elo Zil Shlim, that if there was no Kabbalah, then you have to pay. So what does Rashi say? The Elo Kabu Tosech Alehen. The Amru Lach. Dayanas lan din Torah, zil shlim. Umir mahadur dino lo, but we're not saying that the din gets undone. Amo gamar sabur. V'chi lo naki rishos dinei dinei v'lo mahadur. So what about the first part of that Rashi? Yilo kablu tosech aleihem. The amrulach dayanas lan din Torah. So what is Rashi indicating here about the nature of the Kabbalah?
It used to be within din Torah.
Oh, so then it has to be more, or then, see that, I'm not sure if that's so clear. See, I should announce before asking you to interpret the Rashi any further, that what's been pointed out is that the Rashi seems to be saying two conflicting things. So it's a little bit of a trick question, so should have maybe explained that firsthand. But you could get different impressions from the first part and from the second part. Because the first part says, Elo kablu tosech aleihem. So it sounds like that the alternative here, where he'd be pater, is if they're mekabel his toes. If they say, we accept you, and we accept your mistakes. Anything you do wrong, we understand that's our cost of doing business. But the second part, which Eldar was noticing, sounds the opposite. It sounds like he'll be chayed if they said to him, de amrulach, de yanas lan din Torah, that we require that you judge us accurately. We don't want only what you think. We want the truth. We want the Din Torah. So if they said that, the implication is that that's a chiddush. But if they're just makabel him stam without making that insistence, then they accept his mistakes too. So some of the achronim note that this Rashi seems to be giving you conflicting impressions from the first words to the next words. First words, it sounds like he's off the hook because they explicitly said, we accept your mistakes. And the next words, it sounds like he says, you'd be on the hook if they said, we insist on the accurate thing. So what's the middle? So the Rashi gives a little bit mixed impressions. That's a part of the whole back and forth about this topic. So tomorrow we'll have to say a little bit more about that. And then talk about Shigul Hadas and Dabra HaMishnah and what they mean and what's going on. And then see also some of the practical ramifications for Dayanan, for doctors, and for others. So just to quickly review what we spoke about. So we saw how the three theories that you guys suggested last week all played out in the Rishonim. First of all, we talked also about whether you need a Kabbalah to be done b'kfiyah, that Rishonim, other than Rambam, said even a yachid can be done b'kfiyah. The Rambam sounds like you need rishos for that, but the Tumim said no, that was because he was talking about a non-mumcha. So the question of whether you could be done in the first place with kfiyah, whether that meets Kabbalah, or you can't be done b'kfiyah, so that's also going to affect this whole question of what kfiyah is accomplishing here. So then we took the position of the Balamor and the Ramban that the issue is onus, and in accord with those rishonim who say that Adam Hamazik, the onus gomer, will indeed be pater. And then we talked about how that requires a combination of these elements, that he's a mumcha, so he knows as much as he needs to know, and he doesn't have to account for any ignorance. And they accepted upon him, otherwise we could say, who asked you to get involved? But once they come and they're like, oh, are you okay? So you basically have no choice but to fill the mitzvah of the Torah to be done. It was one possibility. Second possibility is that the Kabbalah is what gets him off the hook, like the Rush sounds like, because if it wasn't the Kabbalah, they still could have it in. So the Chiddush of the Kabbalah is to pater them. And then the third, we notice the Rambam's unusual language, and we mentioned the suggestion that this was an example of Mazik Bereshus. We spoke about Mazik Bereshus, what the phrase abstractly could mean, what could it mean in light of the way the Gemara uses it. So I mentioned it could be the Rishus of the parties, that they're basically Mochel. It could be the Rishus of the Rish Galusa. It could be Hefker Bez and Hefker version of that. Or it sounds like from the Gemara is that it means that the Rishus of the Torah, a person is doing a mitzvah. So that seems to involve some tour. We find the Gemara talks about running around on Erev Shabbos, Ratz Bereshus. We find that reference to Hanukkah candles, you find in the Rishonim, Turim in context of Purim, in the context of Simchas Yontif. So on the later far, a discussion about somebody who's doing a mitzvah with a Sefer Torah and drops it. So all of this may be suggesting the mitzvah p'tur, but then we mentioned from the Chabas Yar and the mitzvah Yisrael and others that we have to be a little bit more careful about it. It doesn't mean that anyone can just run recklessly and do whatever they want if they're on the way to a bris or a shir or something like that. But it means that when you have a mitzvah that everyone knows is going on, and perhaps also that they are equally invested in the mitzvah being fulfilled, so then there is a certain amount of mutual understanding that allows for a p'tur. So in this context, we could say that people need dayanim, people need doctors, and they recognize that that's a crucial part of society, so they understand they can't be so makbik yichut asayra on a mistake that doesn't come from an actual kavana lahazik. And then we talked about some nafkaminas between these different approaches. So one nafkamina that the Shach mentions is, would Kabbalah help also for Gimel Hejotos, who don't necessarily have the same claim to being anusim? And also, the question that Eldar asked, what about defining what kind of Kabbalah is necessary? Does it have to be explicit Kabbalah, or saying that we accept your mistakes, or just the very fact that they come to be willingly judged? Does that itself indicate a Kabbalah? And that's an issue of dispute. And we notice that Rashi is a little confusing on this point, because Rashi, in his first words, sounds like the nature of the Kabbalah is explicit, we accept your mistakes. And in the next part of the Rashi, it says the alternative, when they're not being Kabbalah, is where they say, we require Din Torah, the absolute truth, no mistakes, and therefore implying that the default would be if they didn't say that, then that's as if they're accepting the mistakes too. So we'll have to see a little more about what that's about. Okay, who wants to have a mitzvah for us? Are you here, man? Okay.
You got it first. Ashrei Shreda Zafra.